From the inflatable studios of the North Carolina Reading Service, here comes Indie Week for August the 24th of 2023. This is John Feddersen reading for you. We are boosting our buoyancy today. All for your benefit, blind and print-impaired listeners. Our management wants you to know it's intended to reduce text shocks and bumps to smooth out your Indie Week experience overall. And we will be happily coasting to a smooth halt in about 57 minutes from now. Our regular listeners will remember that we have begun a four-part report about Durham's upcoming municipal election, which I began reading last week. And this is part two, written by Matt Hartman. And it is a long article, but we're going to continue with this lengthy article form. And any time remaining, we'll talk about some education issues that the issue of Indie Week is devoted to. Dances with Death. Brittany Dash was doing everything right. She worked a good job at a bank. She rented a house on an archetypal Durham street, and she took care of her family, not only her five-year-old daughter, Chloe Fennell, who was born with a heart condition that required multiple surgeries, but also her cousin, Brian Luster, who was staying with her while he battled addiction. On July 5th, everything went wrong. While Dash was at work, Luster called 911 to say he was overdosing. Then dispatchers heard him arguing with Dash's 15-year-old niece, Destiny Sidbury, who was babysitting Fennell and a younger cousin. By the time police arrived, Luster had retrieved the pistol Dash kept locked up in the house. Sidbury pushed the younger cousin into a closet to protect him, then dove between Luster and Fennell. Sidbury was shot 7 times, but it wasn't enough to save Fennell. The five-year-old died from her 5 gunshot wounds. "Tell Brittany I tried," Sidbury reportedly told the police. Thankfully, the teenager survived. Fennell's murder shook Durham, but not nearly as much as one might think, given the central role crime has played in local politics over the past 4 years. In the midst of the George Floyd uprisings and a nationwide spike in murders, it was the central issue of the 2019 and 2021 Durham City Council elections. In part, the relative quiet is because the question of Durham's crime prevention strategy appeared to be settled in 2021, when Durham voters decisively elected a moderate slate headed by Mayor Elaine O'Neill that called for both police-friendly tough-on-crime measures and an investment in social programs. But while murder rates are declining across the country, violent crime increased in Durham. Through August 5th, shootings are up 22% compared to 2021 and 28% over 2022. What appears to be a detente in the debate over police reform might prove to be little more than a temporary ceasefire. A single shooting could still spark a political firestorm at a moment's notice. And the legacy of marquee crime prevention strategies of recent years, including HEART, H-E-A-R-T, and Shot Spotter, will depend on the next council's budgets. Like the country's as a whole, Durham's violent crime rate is still far below the highs of the early 1990s, even with recent upticks. But even focusing only on the last 5 years, it's simply not true that the city is suffering a violent crime wave. It's that specific populations in specific parts of the city are. Durham's violent crime is localized to a handful of neighborhoods, including the East Durham blocks surrounding Dash's home on North Guthrie Avenue. According to data, the 2021 Durham Gang Assessment Report, one census tract surrounding Alston Avenue and Lawson Street had 2,544.8 homicides and aggravated assaults per 100,000 people. The city average is 337.8. The 12 most violent tracts account for 15.5% of the city's population, but 60% of its homicides. Unsurprisingly, the trends mirror poverty, which means they also mirror race. Per capita income in the Alston tract, which is 10.3% white and 68% black, is just $10,000 per capita income. Safer areas of the city, like one tract in Watts Hillendale, is 77% white, 6.5% black, and has a per capita income nearly 4.5 times higher at $45,000. If that had been a little white child, oh my gosh, says Cameron Smith, co-founder and executive director of Old East Durham's Communities in Partnership. But because it was a black little girl with a black single mom living in a gentrifying but still majority black community, everybody was like, oh, so sad. Fennell's murder obviously stands out for her age, but Luster, at 42, is also an outlier. Within areas plagued by violence, it's the young who are most involved as perpetrators and victims both. 4 of the 12 people arrested for murder so far in 2023 are juveniles, and the median age of all murder arrestees is just 25.5 years old, according to an indie analysis of Durham Police Department data. For all gun-related arrests, it's 27. Nearly 40% of all shooting victims this year have been 20 years old or younger. Over 80% of this year's 125 Durham shooting victims through August the 5th were black, and same proportion were male. Just 2% were white. Javier Caballero, who is running for re-election this fall, says any guidance counselor or principal in Durham Public Schools can name the kids in their building they're really struggling with. Given those trends, every elected official in Durham is clear that violent crime will not disappear unless the realities of poverty, inequality, unmet mental health needs, and other social needs are addressed. Social ills, excuse me. Council member and mayoral candidate Deidreana Freeman echoes a talking point virtually every candidate for public office shares. Let's get to the root of it and work on that part. In addition to violence interruption and youth internship programs, the heart of the affair is the Community Safety Department, CSD, which was created in 2021. With 4 unarmed crisis response teams, collectively called HART, CSD provides first responders with expertise in mental health care and a team that helps residents navigate care after the initial incident. The program is designed to support people like Luster long before they pick up a gun. Luster accrued more than 50 charges over the 20 years preceding Fennell's murder. HART has proven to be effective and popular, leading the City Council to expand its budget for 2024. It had limited hours and geographic scope during its pilot year, but will now respond to calls across the entirety of the city for 12 hours per day. Caballero says it's been successful because people's needs have been met. If that success has helped quiet the political debate over police reform, it hasn't ended it. The persistence of violent crime means many in Durham are still leery of diverting funding away from traditional armed police officers, and the next city council will have to chart that path forward. Freeman says it was really helpful to come up with a pilot program for interventions with unarmed respondents, but that doesn't address the very real issue of someone showing up with a gun and pulling the trigger. The talking points have become well-worn over the last 4 years. Mark Anthony Middleton says, a lot of the debate, I've said this time and time again, is entrenched in ideological talking points. It's almost reflexive. It doesn't matter what the data says for some folk. The defining question of both the municipal budget and the city council election in 2019 was whether the Durham Police Department needed more sworn officers. Then Police Chief C.J. Davis requested 72 of them. after the grassroots abolitionist organization Durham Beyond Policing led a campaign to instead found a community safety and wellness task force to explore alternatives to policing, that request was reduced to 18 officers. The progressive majority on city council led by then Mayor Pro Tem Jillian Johnson rejected those positions too, opting to increase wages for the city's part-time workers instead. After Davis left Durham to lead the Memphis Police Department, many speculated the lack of financial support was a motivating factor. Davis's tenure in Tennessee has been defined by the murder of Tyree Nichols by a specialized unit she created. 2 years later, with the task force's work underway, Durham Beyond Policing joined with Durham for All, an organization born out of Johnson's original campaign team, to spearhead the fight for HART. The group asked that the funding for 60 vacant police positions be moved to the new department instead. Disclosure, writes the author, I took part in the campaign as a volunteer member leader with Durham for All. The effort fell flat. CSD and HART were created, but only 5 police positions were transferred, resulting in a much smaller pilot program. When Durham voters later that year elected O'Neill and Leo Williams and re-elected Freeman and Mark Anthony Middleton, all of whom share a more moderate approach to crime that includes continuing to invest in policing, it seemed like the possibility of any major transformation to Durham's public safety approach had ended. Middleton says, to say we've reached a point where we need more mental health responders and we can freeze police, to me, it's just unintelligible. I don't know what that means in terms of practical policy making. As the city grows, it will have to expand the police force at the same time, Middleton says. He also championed the use of new policing technologies like that gunshot detection system, ShotSpotter, that he says could increase police efficacy. Middleton's, a lot of the debate, I've said this time and again, is entrenched in ideological talking points. It doesn't matter what the data says for some folk. Many more moderate voters represented by the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, DCABP, which endorsed all 4 2021 election victors, echoed Middleton's views. They saw the progressive campaign as little more than rich white liberals from safe neighborhoods imposing their political ideals on the black Durhamites who were at risk. Omar Beasley, a former DCABP chair, says, people in my community tend to look at the situation as we want to be safe. And if we're not, and if the alleged criminals aren't being held accountable, then crime is going to continue to trend in the wrong direction in our community, like it has been the last few years. Many national polls have corroborated Beasley's perception, showing that while black Americans tend to be critical of police, they also tend to support increased police funding. One Pew poll even found black and Hispanic Democrats are more likely to prefer increased police spending than white Democrats. Jesse Huddleston, a member of the Community Safety and Wellness Task Force, says, at this point, I think there is still plenty of space and imagination to espouse a desire to live in a Durham that is beyond policing, and it's really important to meet real people where they are. From my vantage point, they add, it does not make sense to me to stand on a soapbox and say, get rid of a resource, when the General Assembly is already making it hard for Durham to have resources. However, there are important divisions among the black population. How much confidence black Americans have in the police differs starkly between age groups, and a Pew poll found that differing levels of optimism about change depending on education level and income. In that light, it's worth noting that both Durham Beyond Policing and Durham for All have black leadership. Muffin Hudson, director of the NC Community Bail Fund, and a leader of All of Us or None of Us NC, is a group advocating for the rights of formerly and currently incarcerated people and their families, saying, I want less police. The people that I know want less police. ironically. Muffin Hudson, an avowed prison abolitionist, is also an ally of Freeman's despite their disagreement on policing. Hudson says, me and Driana don't get along like that. Just because we're both black women and we're both from New York doesn't mean we get along. We have some arguments. Her loyalty stems from trust. Hudson says she knows that Freeman, an East Durham resident herself, is honest about her opinion and committed to her community, especially in the raw times right after violence strikes. Hudson says it's always about the people. It's never about her. It's never her personally saying, well, this is what I want. It's what the people are telling her they want. The fact that the priorities page on Freeman's current campaign website doesn't mention violence or policing at all could be a sign that her constituents are asking for a different focus this year. But for Freeman's progressive council colleagues, it shows a political shift that she has been less than straightforward about. Johnson says of the past two elections, the political climate around policing was very intentionally shaped by certain political actors who thought it would give them an edge over the folks who were holding power in the council at the moment. Now that the more pro-police council members are in the majority, it's not a politically convenient issue. The fact is, progressives like Johnson say the root causes of violent crime are too big and too complex for local governments to solve. City governments in North Carolina don't have authority or resources to outlaw guns, pass job guarantees, increase the minimum wage, or anything else that would target the issues everyone agrees are central. But that doesn't make for a good stump speech. Caballero says, the lethality of the actual byproduct of having so many guns on the street, it's impossible to really curtail the violence that we're seeing. I understand why residents don't want to hear that, because it means, oh, you don't have a solution to my problem locally. I'll say this for everyone who is elected in Durham. We all care. We all feel it. I think some of us are willing to be a little more transparent about what we can actually do about it. Jennifer Carroll, a medical anthropologist and member of the Community Safety and Wellness Task Force, sees the issue in the same practical, data-focused way Middleton does, but reaches the opposite conclusion. While Middleton sees the increase in police response as a sign that enforcement-focused approaches like ShotSpotter are working as promised, Carroll sees activity without effectiveness. She says, when we had conversations with the city council about ShotSpotter, there was a shocking disregard to available data. She says, citing evidence from Chicago, that the system increases police dispatches, but seldom leads to arrests or case closures. Given the constraints of local government and the size of that problem, the issue ultimately comes down, as it always has, to prioritizing money. Whether ShotSpotter is effective is not a question answered in isolation. It's answered by comparing it to the impact of HART or increases to the police staffing budget. Hudson says of her support for defunding the police, if we funded more mental health services for folks, if we funded more affordable housing for folks, if we put more money into people's hands and into their pockets, we would have less crime. We would have less need for police officers because people have everything they need, and that's when crime happens, when someone's lacking something. There's plenty that the city could spend money on. Caballero points to parks and rec programming that provides opportunities for young people, as well as improved partnerships with the county, which controls both the schools and social services and thus directs support for the young people who need it. Williams has championed an apprenticeship program to connect those who might commit violent crimes with jobs that offer a better path. Freeman's focus on development is explicitly aimed in bringing resources to divested communities. And, of course, there was the tight budget vote that centered on raises for firefighters and police officers. But there are two issues. The first is, the conflicts dividing the city council have made it hard for such mundane and routine local government projects to find a foothold. Carol says, it can be hard to know who we bring in or who we reach out to for support on a particular proposal if we don't know if the other city council members are returning your call this week. Are we going to accidentally weaken a proposal we feel is helpful for the community? If we pick someone in the middle of an interpersonal conflict we're not able to be aware of? DeWarren Langley, a longtime activist focused on mentoring black boys, says it's just disheartening when you see the posturing of public officials. Langley cites a lack of communication among local officials for duplicative and ineffective spending. For example, Williams is pushing for a commission on black youth, but the county already has a similar program in My Brother's Keeper. Langley says, when it's nearing time to run for office, you see a focus on a political issue in order to have leverage for the next election cycle. When has someone who's always been engaged, I have, emailed for 2 years about boys and young men of color and gotten no response, Langley says. On top of it all, a new state law has made it possible for Hart to expand even further. Senate Bill 77 allows cities to send unarmed civilian personnel to respond to some traffic crashes. For a program that has already seen a massive public campaign for funding, it's an opportunity sure to garner public backing. Which leads to the second issue, whether the city can afford to maintain or expand HART internships, commissions, job training, shot spotter, recreational programs, violence interrupters, and all the other pilots and programs aimed at addressing violent crime. Johnson says the city's money is public money, and we don't have an infinite supply of it. Future councils are definitely going to have to make hard choices with that, and whatever they do will be controversial. Caballero points to the major corporations moving into Durham as a potential solution. She asks, what are you actually giving us? And if they're not giving it, then let's publicly shame them. Like, you're this big employer, what are you providing for Durham? What are the actual dollars to do to the things we need because you elevated our cost of living? In other words, the question of how to fund robust, holistic response to violent crime that everyone in Durham politics desires dovetails with the question of growth. Middleton makes the connection even more explicit, saying, this year's budget is a $600 million budget, almost a $40 million increase from last year with no tax increase. Why did that happen? Because Durham's an it city. Because Durham's hot. Because more people are moving here and helping us pay our taxes, enlarging our tax base. And why are they able to move here? He asks. Well, because of development. And that concludes this second story in this four-part series. I imagine we'll see another article in another week or two. All right, now, as I mentioned, of course, the schools are now open in the Triangle area, at least, and mostly around the state. And I have three school-related articles, at least, to read to you now. Chantel Brown writes about Wake County schools ordered to be more transparent after seclusion and restraint settlement. It happened in front of the entire fourth grade. In February 2019, Wake County parent Jocelyn Pease saw a video of her child, who has speech and learning disabilities, being restrained by school staff inside the cafeteria. In the following moments, the child would be put into a closet and barricaded there by the weight of school staff for 14 minutes. The child would later be placed in 24, quote, timeouts at the school. Peace and her lawyer, Stacey Gahagans, settled a lawsuit earlier this month regarding those timeouts against the Wake County Public School System in federal court. Along with the charges they requested in the settlement, Peace aims to increase public awareness about the national issue of wrongful seclusion and restraint used on students with disabilities. Peace said, it's our right as parents to know when restraint and seclusion have happened to our children, and to have any and all incidents of restraint and seclusion be reported to the U.S. Department of Education Office of Civil Rights, as is already federally mandated. Although each situation is different, there are signs families can look for to remain vigilant about whether this is happening to their child. Seclusion is confining a student alone and in an enclosed space where the student is locked inside or incapable of leaving because of physical, mental, or intellectual capacity. It can happen without a student's family knowing about it. A former teacher, Gehagen is an attorney who represents students with disabilities, and she said it's important for parents to receive a written notification of any student's restraint or seclusion. She said they need to be sure they're reading very carefully what comes home from school. We've had parents that were getting point sheets or things home from school, and there were notations like TO for time out. Parents might think time out means their child was placed in a corner, Gehagen said, and it meant seclusion. Another term schools might use for seclusion is escort. Students with disabilities have an IEP, or Individual Education Plan. IEP usually includes goals for academic progress, plus the related programs and accommodations the children qualify for to help with their mental or physical disability. An IEP also details behavior management approaches and can include seclusion and restraint, but even then with limitations. Nick Lett, an advocate on disability rights, North Carolina's education team, says many students with disabilities end up in specialized behavioral programs within a district. Some programs claim that restraint and seclusion is an essential part of the program and must be used regardless of the parent's wishes or if a student's IEP allows restraint and seclusion or not. This should be a big red flag to parents, and they might want to get more information on the program and how it uses restraint and seclusion, he added. According to Wake County Public School System policy, school personnel may use physical restraint as provided for in state law. That includes restraining a child to remove a weapon or other dangerous objects, prevent or break up a fight, calm or comfort them, to prevent them from hurting themselves, and for self-defense. The policy also allows restraint if it's included in the child's behavior intervention plan. However, if it cannot be done safely, the school's administration should be notified immediately before the classroom staff tries to intervene. WCPSS, quote, provides training and ongoing guidance to staff and administrators in an effort to avoid any noncompliance regarding seclusion and restraint, said a district spokesman. Going on, when allegations are raised regarding the potential inappropriate use of seclusion and restraint, employee relations conducts a review of the allegations and takes personnel action as warranted by their findings. Responses can range from reprimands and retraining for minor violations to suspension or dismissal for severe violations. In P's case, the federal court found WCPSS failed to comply with the state's discipline data reporting procedures. Nor did the district report any use of restraint or seclusion to the Office of Civil Rights during the 2018-19 school year, even though P's child had been secluded and restrained at least 22 times during that period. Gehagen represented another Wake County family whose student was illegally isolated in a storage room during the 2018-19 school year, as reported by WRAL. The most recent Wake County data listed with the Federal Office of Civil Rights are not current, and they don't list any incidents after 2017. During this time, there was no reported instances of Wake County students protected by the Individuals with Disabilities Act being secluded or restrained. Students with disabilities who are in classrooms separate from the rest of the school are at the highest risk for abuse. Even when abuse is suspected, sometimes the justice system declines to investigate due to a lack of evidence or other issues, according to Disability Rights North Carolina's website. Because of their disability, some students can't accurately tell their parents what is happening or what has happened to them. But parents can document alleged abuse in several ways. Parents can photograph bruises they see on their children when they first come home from school. They can also request to pull video from a school security camera, said Gahagan. But sometimes, abuse manifests as psychological problems, not physical ones. Quote, sometimes parents don't know for a long time and they start to see changes in their children. I've had parents say their child starts having more nightmares and separation anxiety and not wanting to be left in a room alone. We've had lots of clients end up in trauma-informed counseling because of how devastating that is to their child. As part of the settlement in Peace case, WCPSS agreed to be more transparent. This includes publishing information about different physical restraint techniques that staff are trained to use on students, as well posting online semi-annual data on the restraint and seclusion of students. Families whose children are in an elementary behavior support classroom must receive all available information about the school's restraint and seclusion practices at their annual IEP meeting. They must be notified by the end of the school day if their child is restrained or secluded. They also have a right to view any available video footage of the incident, which must be kept on file for up to 3 years following the seclusion. Peace said, this lack of transparency and accountability prevents parents from protecting their children who often have challenges communicating in the first place. If parents are aware of this possibility with their child, then they know what questions to ask, can ask to see the places their child will be placed and how they're treated, and most importantly, learn the code words the teacher uses for their child being held in seclusion or physically restrained by staff. The WCPSS board also agreed to retain an independent consultant through the 25-6 school year to review the Elementary Behavior Support Program, visit EBS classes, provide training, and specifically advise regarding the district's practices related to seclusion and restraint. Gahagan said the best thing that parents can do for their children going into this school year is to remain attentive to their children and to their schools. Quote, essentially, if they have children that are nonverbal, that are not in general education classes for the large part of the day, that have behavior issues, that they recognize that this is a possibility of, you know, what could happen to their child. In the IndieWeek.com website is a click for a summary prepared by Disability Rights North Carolina of the law and the rights of children and parents with respect to these issues, seclusion and restraint. And you can go to IndieWeek.com and click at the end of this article that I just read you and find that policy, or go to Disability Rights North Carolina and they'll have that policy. Next, from Jasmine Gallup, writes about two Wake County students who work to ensure that their peers have access to period products at school. The students are working to destigmatize periods with their nonprofit Period Project NC, a journey they started last year in an effort to put free, donated period products like pads and tampons in public school bathrooms. Sarah and I have each had experiences where we bled through our pants and had to go home, Rosaline explains bluntly. We thought, oh, this is a problem a lot of people have had. It's not just that talked about. The two approached their then-principal about putting free pads and tampons in the school's bathroom, and the administrator was initially on board, says Rosaline, but soon started having second thoughts. The teenagers aren't sure why, but they say the principal expressed some concerns about high schoolers misusing the products or being at risk of toxic shock syndrome. That's a rare condition that can occur from leaving in a tampon too long. More likely, their principal was worried about potential backlash, says Rosaline. It's speculation, but in recent years, North Carolina schools have been under intense political scrutiny. Supporting discussions of sex education or even biological realities like menstruation could easily turn into a public firestorm. For girls and women statewide, however, getting a period isn't a subject of controversy. It's an inevitable monthly experience that has to be dealt with. And Rosaline and Pazokian want to make it easier for elementary, middle, and high school students to get the supplies they need during the day. There is some state funding available in North Carolina for public schools to purchase period products like tampons, pads, and even menstrual cups. In 2021, the state legislature started the Feminine Hygiene Products Grant Program, which provided $250,000 to school districts on a first-come, first-served basis. The money ran out in just under 1 week. Last year, the state continued the program, providing grants of up to $5,000 to 35 public school districts and 31 charter schools. The state again exhausted the funding available, receiving more than 100 applications for the grant in about a week. While both Durham and Orange County school districts were awarded grant funds, Wake County was not, and it's unclear whether administrators had applied. Durham Public Schools' 2022 grant application says our schools struggle every day to meet the needs of girls who have no feminine products at home. The cost of providing products each year to students would surpass $5,000, added the application. Many schools have community partnerships that have assisted with this great demand. With that said, this is not sustainable for these schools, and each year the support ebbs and flows while the demand continues to rise. Rosaline and Pazokian each got their periods young, around age 11 or 12. For Pazokian, the experience was pretty traumatic. She knew she was bleeding, but she didn't know what a period was or what was happening. I just went to school, she said. I bled through my pants. I bled on my chair. It was really horrible. With her help from her teacher, Pazokian was able to get some pads from the school counselor. But that experience, having to leave class abruptly, go through adults to get what she needed, stuck with her. Likewise, at Green Hope, pads were only once available at the front office. If you got an unpleasant surprise in the middle of class, you had to cross campus and ask a school administrator for supplies. Pazokian says it's a lot of hassle. It takes a lot of time away from class time, your education, and it's also telling the teacher why you're going to be gone for that amount of time. Across the globe, the number of youth who miss school due to a lack of period products is about 1 in 10, according to a UNESCO report. Even in the United States, where period products are plentiful, students or parents may not be able to afford them. In North Carolina, about 1 in 4 teenagers has missed class due to lack of these products, according to the Alliance for Period Supplies. When Green Hope got a new principal, Allison Cleveland, last year, the girls again approached her about installing these product dispensers in the bathrooms. They tried to keep the proposal as simple and straightforward as possible, lobbying only for pads instead of pads and tampons. This time, they got a firm yes. Pazokian said the need was definitely there in our school. A lot of our friends had similar experiences of bleeding through, so from the female population in our school especially, we got a lot of support, and people were very open to it. Rosaline adds the response from boys in the school has been more mixed. Some classmates thought it was weird when a male student supported Rosaline and Pazokian's endeavor. That's a problem, Rosaline says, because we do have a lot of support from girls, but boys are half the population. They also have to be a support. People think it should be something women should have to fix, that the burden should be on us, and now, especially, more girls' periods are irregular. Not everyone knows exactly when they're going to get their period, so it can be hard to be prepared or know, I should especially be stocked up around this time. Rosaline and Pazokian's success at Green Hope has helped them a lot, as they try to get dispensers installed at other schools. Once principals learn one public high school has already implemented the duo's vision, they're more open to the idea, says Rosaline. Getting dispensers installed in the first school, Green Hope, was the hardest part, she adds. In an effort to expand their operation, the teenagers recruited about 120 ambassadors who advocate for the project in their own schools and help to restock the dispensers. It definitely helps, says Pazokian. The more ambassadors we have in the school, the more likely that will be the school we implement into next. If we don't attend the high school, we aren't as trusted. But if it's someone from their own school who says, this is the need I've seen, then that's better. Today, the duo has successfully installed dispensers at Panther Creek High School in addition to Green Hope. This coming school year, they will also expand the project to Apex Friendship and Lowe's Grove Middle School in Durham. Rosaline is especially excited about installing dispensers at Lowe's Grove because, she says, the school has a significant population of economically disadvantaged students. Period Project NC isn't only about providing free period products to students who can't afford them, but the need is definitely there. Rosaline and Pazokian say about 40% of women in the United States struggle to afford these products, according to the Ballard Center. Pads and tampons can cost up to $240 per year, according to the National Association for Women. And taxes on period product, like the 4.7% tax in North Carolina, only increase unaffordability. Rosaline says, I remember our first week, all the dispensers were completely empty. That was the best feeling because I did wonder if people were actually going to care or use them. The two say they hope to continue to expand this project and install dispensers in more schools across the state. They're always looking for more ambassadors, as well as continually accepting donations for the purchase of dispensers and period products. This summer, Rosaline also traveled overseas to donate products to a school in rural Bangladesh. One day, she hopes to become an OBGYN to advocate for women's health and provide essential care to women in Middle Eastern, North African, and South Asian countries. But even in the United States, we have a long way to go. Rosaline says providing free period products levels the playing field. It also sends a message to female students that their education is just as much a priority as their male peers. The positive response the project has received proves it's needed. And Rosaline says, it's just very securing to know I don't have to worry about my period when I'm at school. At Green Hope's especially, not a lot of the students are thinking about the fact there are people in the school who can't afford these products. It gives me peace of mind knowing that they have peace of mind. Now, Mike McMillan has written about a new program in Durham Public Schools which aims to teach students about investing. Shanisimi Ogede, a 10th grade social studies teacher at Hillside High in Durham, says, some of the students thought it was just a scam. She's referring to her students' initial reaction to a new curriculum on investing and the stock market that was introduced in her class in the fall of 2022. The program is offered to mostly low-income Title I schools through a nonprofit called First Generation Investors, FGI. The brainchild of a group of undergrad students at the University of Pennsylvania who founded it in 2018. Volunteer undergraduates from local universities, from Duke, in the case of Durham Public Schools, teach the course. It made its debut in Durham via Zoom in the fall of 2021. The kicker, in addition to an introduction at how markets work, students receive $100 in real money to invest. Money they get to keep when they finish the program, graduate from high school, and turn 18 years old. Some level of skepticism is not uncommon at the beginning, says Niso Namias, the Duke student who leads the local program. a rising senior. He is the child of immigrants. His father is from Turkey. His mother, Colombia. He says, with some of the students, there's the attitude of what? You're here to save me and you're going to do it with $100? But he says that negativity quickly dissipates once the classes start. Ogidi agrees. The students see, quote, it is not just for rich people. It's not an exclusive club. It's something they can do. The curriculum begins with the basics. What is a stock? How do markets work? It goes on to cover the benefits of diversification, that's owning a range of assets or a broad-based mutual fund, for example, volatility, the market's ups and downs, and dollar cost averaging, which is, means investing regularly to even out the price paid for a stock, bond, or mutual fund, among other topics. It includes sections on bonds, as well as stocks and on exchange-traded funds, a type of pooled investment like a mutual fund. It ends with a requirement that students research and assemble their own hypothetical portfolios. Namias says it's called first-generation investors because most of these kids' parents haven't had the chance to learn what they're learning. The goal is to stop the cycle of some people working hard and investing and others working just as hard but never having the opportunity to accumulate wealth. Decades of study and untold amounts of hand-wringing have so far done little to address that issue, wealth inequality in the United States. There's all kinds of data to support this, but maybe the most compelling number is that at the end of 2022, the top 10% of U.S. households had 68% of total household wealth, most of that concentrated in the hands of the top 1 or 2%, while the bottom 50% had just 3% of the total household wealth, according to the St. Louis Federal Reserve. In his latest book, Poverty by America, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Matthew Desmond writes that over the last 50 years, the poverty rate in the United States has barely budged, falling from 12% in 1970 to 11% in 2019. Whatever your politics, this lack of progress is alarming. To fix this, those on the left might cite a need for higher taxes, more programs to address shortcomings in education, housing and health care, and a greater redistribution of wealth generally. Those on the right will point to the hundreds of billions of dollars that have been spent over that period to apparently little effect. Well, given the seeming intractability of the problem, why not try something different? If its rapid growth is any indication, FGI does appear to be fulfilling a need. From a single high school in Philadelphia, the program has expanded to 63 schools around the country, including 3 in Durham in the latest spring semester. There were 530 program graduates through the spring of this year, according to FGI. In addition to Duke, participating colleges include Atlanta's Spelman and Morehouse Colleges, Harvard, Dartmouth, Yale, the University of Southern California, and UNC Chapel Hill, among many others. In Durham, the first FGI classes were held during the COVID year of 2021 and offered exclusively over Zoom. There was no requirement to participate. Students had to opt in. The inaugural program had 20 participants from Hillside and 12 from Jordan High School. As COVID became less of a worry and students returned to class, this ad hoc approach gave way to something more systematic. This was due in part to legislation that the state passed in 2019 that required all high school students to complete a course in economics and personal finance, EPF, beginning with the graduating class of 2024. Most personal finance courses tend to focus on topics like credit cards, car loans, and mortgages and other forms of borrowing, with only cursory attention paid to the stock market and investing. The FGI program provided the opportunity to remedy that with a ready-made 8-week curriculum that could be quickly introduced into the classroom. Following her experience with FGI, Ogede reached out to Charlene Martin Klein, a social studies curriculum specialist for grades 8 through 12. Martin Klein says, Ogedi saw how our students were responding to the Duke volunteers and their passion for the subject matter and the power of these near-peer interactions. We thought it would be a great resource. Bella Mitchell, a rising senior at Riverside High School, was one of the school's first subjects to participate in an EPF class the fall of 2022. Typical among FGI participants, she had little exposure to investing or the markets prior to the class. She says it was one of the first classes I thought would have importance in the outside world. 100%. Everyone should be exposed to this. Here as elsewhere, the concept that tends to get everyone's attention is compounding. The idea that a small amount of money invested now can grow into something more substantial over time. David Norman, who chairs the Social Studies Department at Riverside and helped pilot the EPF program, a former stockbroker, Norman is a big supporter of financial education and holds an annual workshop on financial fitness for his fellow Durham Public Schools instructor. He says, quote, at their age, 18 years or younger, an investment at $1, compounding at 10% a year, over 47 years will be worth $88 when they turn 65. An investment of $1 compounding at 10% a year, 47 years, will be worth $88 at age 65. No matter whether they're going off to an Ivy League college or entering the workforce after high school, Norman says they all need this information about the markets. The kids at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum, those working at Bojangles 30 hours a week, they're the ones who are eager to find out how this money stuff works. While the $100 provided to graduates won't make anyone rich on its own, it does bring a tangibility to what would otherwise be an abstract exercise. They know $100 isn't a tremendous amount of money, but it makes it more real, and they will have access to it when they graduate. Mitchell agrees. Getting the $100 to invest was really fun, she says. Can it work? Over the past few decades, trends in technology have made it simpler and cheaper to save and invest. There are, for example, multiple micro-savings apps like Acorns, Stash, and Capital, spelled with a Q, that allow individuals to automatically set aside small amounts of money that they can use to buy shares in a stock or mutual fund. The ability to buy what are known as fractional shares, essentially a part of a share, dramatically lowers the price of entry. You can buy one-third of a share of a $300 exchange-traded fund for $100, for example. But for many low-income families, the markets remain a mystery. While about 60% of adult Americans owned a stock, as of mid-2023, those in the bottom 50th percentile owned just 0.6% of the shares, according to Gallup. The top percent held more than half. The rich get richer. Norman says, across three of my classes, I can count on one hand the number of kids who have a clue about any of this. Wealth inequality is education inequality, too. In his EPF course, Norman quickly cuts to the chase. I start with the money, he says. I tell them the great equalizer is that money is not black, not white, it's green, it's a tool. The question is, if the game is rigged, how do you play the game? How do you make your money work for you? Nationally and in the Durham school system, the FGI program is still in its infancy. While the data so far is encouraging, it's far from conclusive. The sample size of graduates is still small, and of course, investing is not without risk. Markets go down as well as up. But Durham at least has seen enough to continue moving ahead. While FGI is not yet a district-wide mandate, the hope is to extend it to reach about 250 students a semester in the 23-4 school year, across the 9th through 12th grades, according to Martin Klein. About 172 students have been through the program so far. Martin Klein says it's really important. They're giving students a chance to do this authentically rather than through a simulation. We hope that seeing their portfolios grow will create a lifelong habit of saving and investing. While many agree that lack of progress in closing the wealth gaps is discouraging, destabilizing from a social standpoint, and without a uniform solution, programs like FGI can be one piece of the puzzle, in Norman's view. As with everything, there's room for improvements. Norman cites an overemphasis on buy low, sell high, always easier said than done. Mitchell, the Riverside student, adds, it would be cool to see some diversity in that program amongst the FGI tutors. Everyone's experience is going to be difficult. Nevertheless, Norman says, it's a hopeful message. FGI is not the only organization working to introduce economically underserved Durham residents to the concept of financial literacy. Michaela Booker, a Durham native who splits her time between here and Atlanta, founded Wall Street Juniors in 2018 to do something similar on a grassroots level. The group focuses on building wealth and fostering entrepreneurship as a way to address intergenerational inequities, holding classes in locations around the city, including at Seed Garden and the Cornwallis Community Neighborhood. But regardless of who is doing the teaching, providing students with an understanding of the time value of money is critical. As Ogade says about FGI, putting money to work in the 10th grade gives it that much longer to grow. That should be helpful when it comes to closing the income inequality gap, a social justice kind of thing. It's an awesome opportunity for the kids. It would be good if every student is given the opportunity to invest before they leave high school. Well, we've cruised smoothly through our 57 minutes of allotted time. And as our inflatable craft bumps gently to a stop, John Feddersen has to close Indie Week this week with several articles unread, some cultural articles, news about the upcoming Hopscotch Festival, music festival in downtown Raleigh next week. So hopefully we'll have time to read some more of that, or some of it in any event. And this podcast will be available after Friday's first airing at our website, and I also encourage you to go online and find IndieWeek.com, which is free, and find if there are links and sidebars to some of these articles that give more detail than I can present in this short amount of time. So from the North Carolina Reading Service, John Feddersen and Indie Week saying so long to everybody, and hopefully you'll join us next issue.